You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
If I were the man I was 5 years ago, I'd take a flamethrower to this place!
All right, I got up early today and caught up with Will Cosentini. Will retired as the as a colonel, working for the commandant and the assistant commandant as one of the military aides. Yeah, that's heady stuff. You better have your shit together. Anyway, he does. Naval Academy guy from upstate New York. I don't even know what that means, but I say it. Outside New York. That means outside New York City. So, and he's a smart guy. And one of the best things about Will is that he's really abrasive. Yeah, it's actually pretty humorous. He's abrasive. So I give his wife a hard time. That's Romeo right there, that guy. She laughs. But Will, yeah. Will Cosentini. Anyway, Will, for a period in his career, it was a foreign area officer, FAO. And so you go to school, you learn the language. After you do that, they send you for a certain period of time to live in the area that you're going to be an expert on. And so Will did that. I think his country of expertise is Egypt. But the whole Middle East thing is what he studied. So had him on to talk about Israel-Iran, what we saw at Gaza the other day, and what the Israelis deal with in that on a regular basis, and also some thoughts about Iraq as well. So he's a fun guy and a smart, smart guy and an abrasive guy. So it's a nice little combination. And he can be angry at times. So all of that coming at you right now here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right, joining me, this is kind of like the smart guy segment of the program. Will Cosentini joins us. He's a he's from upstate New York. Is that upstate New York where you were born and raised? Is there anything outside of New York City, upstate New York?
Not really. I wasn't born here, but I was raised there. So
where were you born?
I was actually born outside of Cleveland.
Well, that's even worse.
My dad, my brother is only a year older than me. He was born outside of Philadelphia. Then they moved to Cleveland. We lived there for a year. I was born there. We moved. My sister was born in Minneapolis. Then we were in Milwaukee. And then my parents moved to Binghamton, New York. Lived there for a few years. And then we moved into a little town outside Ithaca. And my parents, they still live up there. They don't live where I grew up. They moved about 10 miles from there. But my dad started a business and ran a business for 30-odd years in Ithaca, New York, and they still live up there.
So what was he doing when you guys were moving around?
He was he's an electrical engineer.
Ah.
And so he worked for, I think that there was an organization that basically just had a pool of engineers that they would throw at different projects. And so he did all kinds of different stuff and eventually got a degree in like 1970, a master's degree in computer science. And his business, his main line of business was when you take a vibration sensor and a vibration readout, you need to filter it electronically. And so he built these super high-tech filters. And if you think about some of the applications in, like, wind tunnels and nuclear submarine silencing, and now they're in MRI machines, and so super high-tech kind of stuff, but a niche little business that he was able to start in, like, 1977 or 78 when you're borrowing money at 15%. And you just retired from it. You retired in 2013 when I retired from the Marine Corps. So he was like 78 years old, ran it for 30-something years, and it's still going.
Living the American dream, man. American dream, start your own business,
yeah.
Right? Right.
I literally started it in the corner of his partner's bedroom.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I'm not okay with that. But what you know, if that's what you have to do, that's what you have to do. Small businesses happen like that. So that's where you get your analytical mind from your father, engineering.
My dad is a super smart guy. He graduated high school when he was 16, and he went on scholarship to City College in New York, which at that time in the 50s was known as the finest public university in the country. Colin Powell went there, was in the ROTC program, I think a year or two behind my dad.
Really?
So he graduated college when he was 20 years old, and you know how that calculus points, maybe 2 points in high school or college? I mean, my dad knows that stuff, right?
Wait. You broke up when you said, you know that something, something, something. What was that? What's that something, something, something?
Like all that calculus that you took in high school or in college for a year.
Oh, yeah.
And you got through it.
My dad
knows that stuff. Like, freeform.
He understands it?
I mean, smartest guy I ever knew in my life. And ran a business. And there's you know, two different things there. You gotta have the idea, but then running the business, you gotta know people, and you gotta have real guts to make decisions. So, great American role model.
Wow. All right. So a little bit behind the curtain of Will. This is your life, Will. Talk to me about he's in Will's a Naval Academy guy, infantry guy, retires. How many years have you been retired now?
I retired in the summer of 13, so coming up on 5 years.
Wow, coming up on 5 years. Okay, so Will and I, we taught together at the basic school, and so that's where our paths cross, and then have been friends since. What I want to ask you about the Middle East. Will is a feo. Now, in Spanish, that means ugly. Okay, that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about a foreign area officer, yes?
Correct.
Okay, all right. And so his nation of expertise is Egypt, but as part of the Egyptian thing, you got to be familiar with the region. So, we're watching the dance that Israel does now, with a whole series of partners, most recently in Gaza with Hamas, the week before that with, Iran in Syria. What we saw on television, 2 days ago, what was that about? Can you explain the choreography behind what we saw on TV? At least give us your take on it.
Yeah, so I think it's pretty obvious that, people are trying to influence opinion around the world, right?
Right.
Hamas cannot defeat Israel.
Right.
And so the only way they can defeat them is to either from inside of Israel, and there's a significant faction of Israelis, you know, that are against any military sort of operation in and around Gaza, or against settlements, or against all that stuff. You know, Israel is a lot like the U.S. politically. It's very, very evenly divided. And so they're trying to influence that, maybe to disturb Israeli public opinion. And then the second part is to get sort of all the center and center left and all the lefty parties across Europe, North America, and everywhere to be anti-Israeli and attempt to isolate them because they can't defeat them heads up. And so they do a very, very sophisticated, well, quasi-sophisticated propaganda effort into the idea that we're very weak and we're just protesting what should be our natural rights. You know, we live here and we're held in this prison, it's Gaza, and look at the Israelis, they're in armor and helmets and rifles, and they're using chemical weapons on us, i.e. tear gas, and blah, 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 to attempt to implement public opinion. And you know, it's for the people that want to be influenced, they're very easily influenced, right?
Right.
For anyone who really wants to dive in and do anything, just the next level of research, it's a sham. The idea that Hamas, an Islamist party, wants a two-state solution. You know, Hamas wants to march its Jews into the sea. And the part of Israel that's against all of that politically understands that fundamentally. And the part that isn't, I think, is deluding themselves. Now, they're in a tough spot, right? For them to truly live in peace, how do you live in peace with someone? Well, you defeat them. You defeat them utterly so that they know they're beaten. Then you can live in peace with them. And Israel could not defeat them utterly in 1948 or in 1967 or in 1973 or 1980s or even today. It's not allowable under modern convention. And so they're stuck with this situation that they attempt to manage, and they attempt to manage it in a sort of modern Western way, and it means that they're going to be at risk forever. And one thing they won't do is allow themselves to be like under an existential risk. And so when Iran gets a nuke, stand by, because the Israelis are not going to tolerate that. So
what we saw on TV, that was made for television viewing, and this whole idea that somebody on the other side of that fence, that the Hamas ops people are somehow or other bothered by all that, is that a fool's view of it? That as sure as the sun comes up this morning, that those people got sent out there, that choreography was done knowing what the Israelis' response would be and looking to have that response documented on television and shown to the world?
Yeah, I think that the organizers that absolutely know that. I think that there's some people in that crowd that know that. And I think there's a significant part of the population that's been radicalized that would disagree with that, that it's completely heartfelt. They're completely in the right. Israel is completely wrong. But it's like any
right.
Big protest in the United States, right? How much of it is grassroots and how much of it is astroturf? Yeah, there's probably not anything that's 100% purely grassroots. But I think that a big chunk of that demonstration is astroturf. And I would draw a straight line from that back to the $100-odd billion in cash money that we gave to Iran to make the deal. We gave $120 or $140 billion. That's insanity, right?
No, you don't understand. It's called putting Iran in a box. We won't associate their behavior in the Middle East with this deal. It allows Europe to do business. Come on, man. Why are you being such a conservative?
And I absolutely guarantee that part of that $140 billion is funding the people that started that in Gaza this week, last week, 2 weeks ago, whatever.
Okay. All right.
Got a paycheck.
All right. Next subject. Israel and Iran in Syria. Israel shot 70 missiles at various targets, according to what I read in the open source media, to include radar and missile installations. So they prosecuted their list of targets. There's been no response yet from Iran based on that. Are we going to have a war in Syria between Iran and Israel, or will the Iranians not do that because they know that the Israelis won't stop in Syria? And I offer you the quote, if it rains in Israel, it will pour in your country. It didn't say it will pour on your military targets in the region, okay? It didn't say we will annihilate your proxies. It said it will pour in your country. Now, to me, that was, although veiled a bit, it was pretty ominous. I'm curious about your thoughts.
Yeah, I don't think that's veiled. I don't think that's veiled at all.
All right.
So where is Israel, right? I think that no one can complain when someone throws a rock over the fence from Syria to Israel. Israel throws a rock back over the fence. But at what point do they actually make it rain in Iran? And if they do make it rain, you know, what's the target set? And do the Iranians, do they think that they can get some leverage if the Israelis really step out and attack a sub-broad target set in Iran? Or is that regime shaky enough that if the Israelis, who the Iranian regime has propagandized, you know, internally to Iran as being, they can't stand up to the great Persians. If the Israelis can strike a real blow, does that bring potential political harm to the regime there? So they're playing a little bit of a game. And I think if you're in Tehran, I would not discount Netanyahu, right? I would not discount the fact that you push him to a certain point and you actually don't know where that line is, that he's actually going to make it rain. And in 1980 or 81, it would have been different. But I think that regime is a lot shakier now, a lot shakier. And so they may not want to go. They may not want to play that game of chicken. Because I think they're pretty confident the Israelis are not going to back away. So,
you know, playing chicken with the Israelis, it's like playing chicken on your bike with a kid that really doesn't understand the concept. You know, like, you know, you're supposed to take your front wheel and you ride up behind somebody and you play chicken and you bounce your, front tire off his back tire and you make him wobble and stuff. It's like you play that game with a kid who really doesn't understand it and he smashes into you and knocks you off your bike and you're laying on the ground and you look at him like, are you stupid? What is wrong with you? Don't you know how to play the game? And he says, no, I don't. I don't. I thought I was supposed to knock you off your bike. Not like that, you dope. What's wrong with you? It's the Israelis are that kid. And I agree with you. The silence after Israel went down their target list, to me, is deafening. Now, some analysts have said, oh, well, they're going to hit in another way, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, that's not how you play that game. Okay? That's not how you play that game.
Think of the region now. It's been U.S. policy since like 1995 that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, that we should put our embassy there. And so Clinton, Bush, Obama, all that was the avowed policy that they all campaigned that they were going to do, and they didn't do it. and Trump did it. And so, you know, these various U.S. administrations have been warm or cool on Israel. I think right now there is no doubt that the current administration backs them to the absolute hilt. And so why would Netanyahu or any Israeli premier from anywhere on the right side of the spectrum back away? Right? You're never going to be in a more strong position. And I think that the rational actors over there probably have got that. So I think that Israel is in a tremendously strong position to retaliate overwhelmingly should it be called for.
All right. No.
And you know what? The Germans won't like it.
It's interesting. A. Merkel, I can never remember if her name is Angela or Andrea, so she's A. Merkel on this program. Germany is whatever. A. Merkel. All right. So Germany is the weak link in Europe, and it bleeds into the Middle East. Germany emboldens Vladimir Putin by not having a military. All right. The strongest economic power in Western Europe, in Europe, period, doesn't have a military. So when they say, hey, you need to stop that, what are you going to do about it? Well, nothing. We can wring our hands and we can piss you off so that you cut off natural gas that supplies us now. But other than that, nothing. Okay, then shut up. So to me, and so then what is their, of course, their only concern with the Iranian nuclear deal is, look, it impacts our business. We don't care if they ever get a nuclear weapon. We don't even care about that. You know, we may wring our hands and stand with everybody, but we're really, the only card we play in this game is an economic card. And so Germany, to me, freeloading Germany is in timeout corner right now. Okay, I don't like Germany. And to me, this whole idea of, you can only be a pacifist when somebody else guarantees your ability to be peaceful and to exist. Because without that, you're a victim.
In fact, they're smarter than you. They're smarter than you. They've evolved.
I know it happens to me.
Beyond that, they're borderless, and no one's ever going to hurt them. And why can't we all just get along? They're smarter than you.
They're really not.
Yeah, no shit.
They're really not. Because even though I come across as a pedestrian, just so everybody knows, I'm not, okay? Okay? I'm smart. And a lot of times people say, hey, if you have to tell people you're smart, you're not smart. Okay, that's not true, okay? I don't believe that for a second.
My point is, this is a basic fundamental that since the time of, written human history, is that you can't surrender, you can't appease your way to peace and prosperity and security. And so the Germans and look, they...
I know, Will, but let me...
But they're stupid.
Let me tell you,
They're going to relearn this again.
No, isn't that a fairly novel concept? Peace through strength? Isn't that something we're just learning for the first time now? That when you look at nations like China and you look at nations like Russia, Iran, North Korea, that it's good to have strong alliances. That seems to be a lesson that we're learning for the first time, yes?
No, the Greeks knew it in 400 BC.
Damn it. The Greeks. The Greeks. What? It's stunning to me, right? The only way you to assure that you won't fight is to make sure that it's an unfair fight. And then you can go fight wars like Desert Storm, you know? And there, you know, it's no fuss, no muss. If you want to fight, be weak. Vacillate. Okay, so I want to ask a question about the Arab world, which is your specialty. not a whole lot of outcry from the Arab world about what happened in Gaza. talk to us about the changing and shifting sands of the Middle East, where we find Arab nations aligned with Israel now. What's going on?
I think it's purely interests, right?
Right.
And that an Iranian nuke, I think the Saudis have declared, the Egyptians have declared that an Iranian nuke means that they need a nuke. And so an ascendant Iran is not good for traditional power centers. And while they've propagandized their own publics for so long about the evil of Israel, they would just as soon not see an ascendant Iran. And I think also, I think they're just tired of the Palestinians. They really do.
Really?
That's a feeling, and I don't like to go on feeling, but, I mean, think about it. It's been 70 years?
Yeah.
70 years. I don't know. They're tired of it.
All right.
And it's interest. Their interests align more, not necessarily with a triumphant Israel, but against an ascendant Iran.
You know, it's interesting because an ascendant Iran finds itself in a, as you said earlier, and I believe you're right, finds themselves in a precarious position where the Israelis pulled their punk card, and if they were sure about domestic politics, which they're not, they would have hit back in some way, shape, or form. But if you notice the targeting that the Iranians did when they shot their 20 missiles, when they stuck their toe in the water, it was only in the Golan, right? It was not in the Israel proper. Because the whole proverb that got thrown out there, make it rain in Israel, it will pour in your country. If an Israeli dies, via a missile launched from Syria by Iranians, that to me is somebody in Iran is going to die. There are going to be a lot of people that die in Iran via Israeli military technology. And so, to me, I agree with you. I don't think the Iranians are sure about themselves domestically to bite off that chunk. And I think that's a very interesting dynamic as this thing goes forward, in that the Iranians overplaying their hand. And to that extent, I want to ask you about, if you read for domestic consumption, Muqtada al-Sadr, if you can believe that, is winning with, last I saw it was 91% of the precincts counted in Iraq, the parliamentary election. He has been blocked, right? And the domestic reporting on this is bad because until you go to like Al Jazeera and Middle East publications and begin to read, what you get is you get the Muqtada al-Sadr from 10, 13 years ago. He's not that guy anymore, right? Iran does not want him in power in Iraq. And you read that and you're like, what? Right? Because the domestic spin is that Sadr, Iran, right? The Middle Eastern spin is Iran doesn't like Sadr. Sadr, picture of Sadr in Jeddah of all places, meeting with, Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And you're like, what? He was where? How did that happen? So I'm curious, Iraq, what's going to happen there? And then let me complete the little piece as I view it. Iraq needs Western capital to fund the rebuilding of their nation, or else it will stay in rubble for decades. right? The only way that that capital comes is if there's some kind of political settlement and stability in Iraq, which means the Sunnis and the Shiites and the Kurds have to get to the table together, okay? I don't know how that happens. But if it doesn't happen, you can align yourself with Iran, but there's no money coming. And you are going to have this civil war forever. Okay, so in the midst of all that, with Iran looming in the background, give me your thoughts on Iraq and where it fits into all of this.
Yeah, and, you know, I find Iraq very hard to understand now because so much has changed, you know, in the last 10 years or even the last couple of years, last year. And it's hard to gauge how far things got pushed, and so is there an idea of any sort of reconciliation amongst the parties? Because they're all reasonably equal as well, so there's no one there that feels defeated, but they've got to make a deal.
Right.
And so if the Iranian influence is on the wane because of, you know, things that are happening inside Iran or in Syria, et cetera, does that drive the Shia to be more open and less ascendant? Iraq, straight up, your analysis, I think, is absolutely correct. No Western capital, then they actually are never going to progress. And how do they get that? Do they have autonomous regions? A very loose federal system? Because I don't think they're ever going to trust each other to have a true, strong central government, even if it's in any kind of a coalition. And so how do you get that sort of autonomous where we're willing to do some things and we're willing to not fight, but we're not really willing to live together? You know, I think that's really hard to do. They may get driven to it. They may be able to cut deals on the side. The geography is so screwed up, I don't know if they'd be able to do that. So, yeah, it's hard.
Yeah.
Is that wishy-washy enough for you?
That was kind of wishy-washy for you. You tend to be more of a black and white guy.
This one, I think, is really, it's hard and I think it's really hard to analyze from here.
Okay. All right, do you know Jerry Durant?
We've met. I wouldn't say I know him.
Okay. He still does contractor work over there. General Staff College development and support, language schools for the military. And so he's there, I want to say, on a either monthly or bi-monthly basis as he moves in and out of the country. He says more and more the Iraqis that he talks to are coming to the conclusion that there is no way that they can survive unless the country is partitioned, unless there's some kind of agreement on a federal power sharing revenue, federalized kind of republic, power sharing, revenue sharing, provincial government kind of stuff, that they can't survive. And I said, what's the biggest concern? He said, well, the biggest concern of my people is getting to and from work and not getting assassinated. So it hasn't changed, and they're tired of it. And if Iraq cannot exist as it did under Saddam, which is via a strong hand that forces everybody to stay in line, and they don't see that, they don't see that person, because you cannot control ISIS, because even though now its territory has been taken from it, it won't go away. It will seep back into Baghdad. It will seep back into Shiite neighborhoods, and it will explode cars whenever it can. And they're tired of it. And so it's kind of interesting to talk to him as he moves in and out of the country and talks to people that work for him. And he has Christians, Muslims, Sunni, Shiite, and Kurds all working for him. And so his take is pretty interesting.
I would say, though, that the people that are going to push for a partition are the people that are sitting on top of the oil. Right? And if you're not sitting on top of the oil, are you going to trust that the guy that's sitting on top of the oil that's pumping it is going to be transparent in what the revenue is and what the revenue sharing is? That's always going to be the bitch.
Right. That is the bitch right there. The oil. Right.
Yeah. And,
but I think what has to happen is there has to be this notion among the general population that, look, unless we do this, this isn't going to stop. And so they have to get tired enough. So how many years do you have to do it before you get tired enough that says, hey, get rid of this, make it stop, okay? Why can't we just live in peace?
Yeah, but how long does that take?
I'm 70 years, 80 years. I'm not sure. So we're 10 years.
I mean, look,
we're 10 years.
Our Civil War ended in 1865, and we actually didn't fully enfranchise Black America until 1965. It's 100 years.
So what are you telling me? What are you trying to say to me, that we've got a ways to go?
I would say that in things like this, the best thing you can do is win your war, right?
Right.
Make people feel defeated. And if you don't, man, you got a hard problem on your hands.
Okay, I want you to expound on this concept of make people feel defeated, because that's the third time that this has come up in this discussion. So talk to me. Talk to me about make people feel defeated. What is significant about that?
Well, I mean, the whole Clausewitzian idea that war is an extension of politics, right? If you don't impose your will on people, then they're not going to do what you want. Every military officer fundamentally knows that. The application of it can be pretty challenging, and in the modern world, it's really hard to do. The things that we did in World War II, right, at the micro-tactical to the grand strategic level, the things that we did in World War II would be completely and absolutely unacceptable to America, at least to the modern America media. So how do you impose your will in Desert Storm, right? We didn't do it in the march up. So how do you get people to know that they've been defeated? It's hard. But if you don't, right, you're never going to get out of the conflicts part of this spectrum where war is part of that political spectrum.
Okay, so how do you make how do you make somebody? It's kind of interesting, because I was talking to Butch Neal earlier this week, and something like this kind of came up. You recall in Desert Storm, as the Iraqi army tried to get out of Kuwait City, they ran into a little bit of a traffic snarl northwest of the city. It became known as the Highway of Death. And at first, it was like, yeah, they're getting their ass kicked. But then, the longer it went on, it was, what are the Americans doing? So I want you to visit that in the concept of making somebody feel defeated, because that's what was happening. Somebody was getting defeated there. You're not surrendering. You're a military vehicle.
We flinched. That's what happened. We flinched. What did Curtis LeMay done? Curtis LeMay would have brought on another bomber wing and then another bomber wing.
we lost you for a second. And it broke up after the second, and another bomber ring. And it would not have been, it would have been a small, maybe 1 inch or 2 inch column at some point in an American newspaper that 8th Air Force flexes its muscle or something like that. Right?
Ranking up now. I'm in a part of middle America where we don't have good cell phone coverage, if you can believe it or not.
All right. So what is this? It's a play to, it's a media play?
I mean, media, public opinion, you know, even in our country, you've got to, you have public bond. We, in Desert Storm, we barely had the confidence to start the war, and we definitely didn't have the confidence to finish it right. You know, we were willing to take two-thirds of the cake instead of grabbing the whole cake. And that was good enough. And as a result, we were back. We were back in 2003.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Is that forced upon us because of the coalition we built? That we have Arab partners in this, and all of a sudden they come to the table, and now it's a real problem? Is that part of coalition warfare where your coalition isn't that narrow, it's a little bit broader, and so we can't do...
No.
At
some point, what is the coalition? Are you going to play for the lowest common denominator or not? And if you are... then what's the value of it? Important part of the coalition, US-UK. Everyone else is a minor partner, and we didn't accede to what they wanted. Yeah, the Russians. We did enough to keep them in, but they weren't really truly the coalition that you think of.
Right.
If you need every partner in your coalition, I mean, look at what we did in Afghanistan. Oh, we need all these different partners. And as a result, we had this pig's breakfast of a chain of command that ended up with more dead people. Stupid.
I'm afraid that we're going to lose you. So, look into your crystal ball and answer the question, does Israel go to war with Iran in Syria and then it bleeds into Iran anytime soon? Or will the Iranians beg off of that one? And we lost him. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt. Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay,
good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the group can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I can do anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are. I want to wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so I don't cry.
Ten minutes after 10 o'clock. You know, it's funny just to read headlines. I'm going to read you some headlines. Okay. I won't even tell you who they're from, okay? This is World Headlines. White House brushes aside North Korea's threats to cancel summit with Trump. Next headline, North Korea threatens to pull out of Donald Trump's summit. Next headline, North Korea cancels high-level talks with South Korea. Next headline, meet Kim Jong-un, the Korean GOAT, which stands for greatest of all time. Next one, Americans support talks with North Korea, remain skeptical of outcome. Next headline, the gullible Trump finally finds out Kim Jong-un isn't honorable. Now, can you imagine what the headlines would read if the President of the United States, and I would say take Donald Trump out of it, but that's impossible. Can you imagine if the President of the United States didn't pursue these talks, that there was overtures made, and the President of the United States didn't pursue them, right? I mean, they would be going hysterical. You know, there is a possibility, even if it's the remotest possibility, that denuclearization could happen on the Korean Peninsula, and he is not taking it seriously. He is not pursuing it. I mean, and since then, listen to when you listen to Will Constantini, so somebody has to know they're defeated. If you don't know you're defeated, then you don't have to accept any of the conditions of the peace. And you know, and one of the things we've done with warfare is that we've insulated a lot of the parts of a population from the outcome of it. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? You want war to be not done very often. You want it to be because you don't want to go down that road because it's catastrophic for a population. You simply just, you know, you want, if at all possible, you know, you certainly want to stay away from that. But if you're not defeated, what's the point? Why stay away from it? We can survive this. We can swim around this. Right? We can navigate this. We'll manage it. All of that. And it just doesn't, you know, I don't know. It's an interesting concept that Will talks about, that they don't know they're defeated. So we do this. When you've been defeated, you tend not to act like that. Germany didn't act like that after World War II. Japan didn't act like that after World War II. They were defeated entirely, unconditionally. They surrendered without condition. Do we do that anymore? No. Right? We ejected Iraq out of Kuwait. They went home and resumed things. On the march up, mostly military targets. Some, but, you know, I will say this. Iraq has been essentially destroyed by this. Baghdad continues to function when there's not bombs going off. And when there are bombs going off, then what? Yeah, good question. Then what? So, yeah, the whole concept of defeat. Do they have any reason to change? They weren't defeated. Their military was destroyed, but life went on for them. Anyway, all right, that'll do it. I think we're talking about the Navy tomorrow. Yeah. At least that's my hope. I'm waiting to hear from somebody. So that's my hope. And then I'll have a stand-in for the gunner. Yeah, one of his friends. So don't miss it. So on a Wednesday, hump day, across America. Happy Wednesday. Have a good day. If you tuned in late, news headlines coming up next. I'll explain the size of a meth tomorrow. I will explain. Yeah, I'll do it tomorrow. But the way a Marine Corps air ground task force, called a MAGTAF, is organized into three essential elements. There's a ground combat element, there's an aviation element, and there's a support element. Okay? So no matter what we do, we go with those elements. And the beautiful part about that organization is it can be tailored depending on what we're doing. So if we're doing humanitarian stuff, it can be, we can have more water purification involved in it. We can have more generators involved in it, so we can make it more crisis response stuff. But there's still an aviation component. There's still a ground combat, a security component to it. But the ground combat would be de-emphasized, and the support would be emphasized. There's certain theaters where aviation plays a predominant role. So you have a smaller ground combat element, you have a larger air component and a support. So the support goes along to support whoever else goes. And then there's us as we're traditionally configured, and that would be with a pretty robust ground combat element, a robust air combat element, and a robust support element. So those three elements. Think of it as about 30,000 Marines. 10,000, 10,000, 10,000. Although those aren't really the numbers, right? So of the 30,000, you know, who are the trigger pullers? They tend to be ground combat people, infantry people, although there are truck drivers and other people that do security that get involved in it. But when you're thinking about the closing part of it, the locate close with, some people bump into people. Other people, it's their job to go find them and shoot them. So, in the email that asked me to explain, the people who have a job of finding them and killing them, that's a relatively small number. So, smaller than the 1/3 of the 30,000. So, I will break that down in a little bit more detail. Have a great day. This program repeats itself momentarily on a Wednesday. All Marine Radio. Uh-oh. Hold on. Let me do that again. Take two. On a Wednesday. All Marine Radio. Uh-oh.